Welcome to the MacGuffin. That quick inhale you just heard is James, and I'm Alex. Before we get started, I want to get you to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. It's got all of our previous episodes. We're almost up to 200, plus about 4 billion minisodes. so you can find those all on themacguffinmen.com. Also, follow us on Twitter, at themacguffinmen. And subscribe to us on iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and tell any tramps or vagrants that you know about our podcast so that they can subscribe on their iPhones, because I think homeless people have iPhones now. But yeah, we'll just get to the theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Uh-huh.
What are we talking about?
City Lights.
Okay, there we go. It's a very brief introduction to this film.
Do you want a longer one?
Sure. Let's get some more details.
1931 City Lights?
Correct.
Charlie Chaplin's City Lights?
I prefer to call him Chaz Chap, but yeah.
I call him Chappy.
That certainly seems part of the times.
It's so many Chappy jokes running through my head while preparing this podcast.
I just really enjoy calling people Chaz, so whenever I get the opportunity, I'm going to go for it.
Yeah, we were talking about Charlie Chaplin, one of Charlie Chaplin's most well-respected movies, mm-hmm. City Lights, which came out in 1931 and is a silent movie, a mostly silent movie. Mm-hmm. A bit of a hybrid for reasons we'll probably talk about later. 1931's late for silent movies, though. This is kind of when the era of the talkie is kind of already on us at this point. But Charlie Chaplin was very good at making silent movies. Yeah.
and also didn't like letting go of things.
Yeah, well, sure. But he also just had a lot of power and a lot of clout at this point in his career, and really could do whatever he wanted.
Yeah, exactly. Like if you are one of the four heads of a studio, you know, and can produce your own work, you can keep doing your work however you want, you know?
Yeah, and there's a ton of ways that Charlie Chaplin's career is really unprecedented. And as you said, he and three other people started United Artists in 1919. And, you know, it did come under a lot of financial trouble. But the idea of artists having this kind of control on the production and marketing and distribution of their work was just very unprecedented, very ahead of its time. It's still something that we're just kind of getting a grip on now with the internet. People are kind of doing this again. So for him to be doing this almost, you know, 100 years ago is pretty insane to me.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the closest sort of parallel is what the dream of DreamWorks was when Spielberg was one of the three with Katzenberg and Geffen. When they were starting DreamWorks, the idea was that so Spielberg could just produce whatever he wanted to. And DreamWorks didn't end up becoming that, but it was sort of like, we're going to do this like United Artists style. Like it was the template for any time an artist sort of starts a production company to help make their own work, and starts in DreamWorks' case, starts a studio, and in United Artists' case as well.
Yeah, and just
like the whole even the name is like United Artists. We're keeping capitalism out of this. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you hear about people Judy Garland doing Wizard of Oz and the kind of things that a lot of these people who are now such well respected actors and actresses, the absolute shit jobs they had to go through at the time, mm-hmm. and just the way the studio system worked. And as I said, that studio and kind of as you pointed out, every subsequent one doesn't really reach that 100%, or at least not forever. But it should be pointed out that Charlie Chaplin, just after so much success, and again, another unprecedented thing about him is what a gigantic star he was, like to the degree that the world had never seen a performer be a star like this, mm-hmm. at up until this point. That success led him to have a lot of the control of what he has. And it's, you know, the legacy of Chaplin's huge. And part of it is because he really got to be an auteur before anyone else had really coined the term for what he was doing. Mm-hmm. He got to write, he got to direct, he got to star, he got to edit. And that's just an incredible amount of control for anyone to have now, let alone back then when, you know, this technology was not as widespread. There was fewer companies. It was harder to just go out and, you know, make a video with some of your friends on your own. There was just so much overhead involved that that's part of why his works are so well respected, is because you can kind of trace them all back to one person. And that's crazy to think of now, let alone at the time he was doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Like the only person I can think of that was even kind of famous for being a director at the time is D.W. Griffith. And his work is mostly remembered now for being profoundly racist. So, you know, it's he has sort of fallen away from time. And yes, Chaplin has proven to be sort of the as an auteur, the first really bright shining star that succeeds over a number of films, right?
Yeah, exactly. And
because I don't think either of us could name another Griffith film off the top of our head.
No, definitely not. Yeah, so that's kind of one of the things that's made him, I mean, to this day, still one of the most recognizable movie stars on the planet, which is pretty incredible considering how far pop culture has come in the meantime and how big Hollywood is now. And you know, the world becoming a smaller place, the globalization. It's incredible that someone who was around before so much of that is still so widely understood, widely recognized.
Yeah, for sure. And next year, Just for Laughs, they're doing a Chaplin hologram.
I hope that's true.
It's 100% not true.
I know it's not.
But you wouldn't be surprised if it happened.
No. Okay, well, let's talk about City Lights then. I'm sure we'll talk about more about Chaplin and his career, but let's get to City Lights.
Okay.
We both just saw this in theaters.
We did. In different theaters.
In different theaters.
Different city, different theater.
Same time, though.
Yeah, exactly. I almost went to the 4:45 show to fuck with you, but then, then things came up.
And text me spoilers.
No, there's no talking in this movie.
His mustache is little.
Is that the Michael Jordan mustache?
Yes, that mustache, famously known as the Michael Jordan mustache.
Yeah, I had never seen this film before. I know I had seen Chaplin before, but I think only shorts. I can't recall. But yeah, I enjoyed it. I strongly suspect you enjoyed it more than me, but I'm happy I've seen it, and I enjoyed it. I see the appeal. But yeah, I mean, I liked it. I wasn't crazy about it. Yeah.
Have you seen other silent movies?
Yes,
like full length.
Yes,
and
it's yeah. I mean, it's just sort of part of it is just the standard with going back in time stylistically is that every time you go back a decade, you kind of remove a decade of invention in cinema, right? And so it's just it's tricky. So I was interested in watching for stuff like that, but very, you know, very static camera in this film. The focus doesn't change in the middle of the shot because I suspect it was pretty much impossible. I think there are two dolly shots in the movie, which are really nice shots, but I later found out that Chaplin just sort of liked a static camera in general. But yeah, it was interesting, and certainly interesting as a product of the times and very interesting historically. And Chaplin was obviously very talented.
Yeah. Where were the dolly shots?
In the spaghetti restaurant when they're going through the dancers, I believe.
Right.
It's either that scene or the party, but there's just two. I think there were two of them going through this crowd of dancers, and they sort of end up with the tramp.
Yeah, and I think it doesn't when he starts dancing with that one girl who's about to dance with her date, I think that's when they pull back on one and kind of follow him going all nuts to the dance floor, maybe.
Yeah, that could be true. I think that's what it is.
Yeah. Anything surprise you? Anything you were surprised to see in a 1930s movie?
I don't know. There must have been something. No, I can't think of anything off the top of my head.
Plain spaghetti.
Well, that did surprise me and made me hungry. That is a restaurant I would like to go to. I want pasta without the oppressiveness of sauce. But what about yourself? Had you seen this before?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. It's actually not even my favorite Chaplin, but it's good, and I understand its appeal. And a lot of Chaplin historians kind of look at it as a quintessential one, because it is a talkie, but as we said, it's a bit of a crossover. So we do still get we get the score, which is written by Chaplin, or most of it, except the things that he stole. and it's a little bit kind of not political, but kind of touches on some political subjects and some socioeconomical things that you know, by the time The Great Dictator comes out almost a decade later, he's certainly leaning a lot heavier on.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's kind of in a transitional period for him. It's kind of a combination of different eras, but we also still get to see a lot of the things we see more of later on. And so I thought it was a good one for us to do. And then just the chance to see it on the big screen was definitely another bonus.
Yeah, it's always the best way to see anything.
Yeah, even Inherent Vice, right?
Are we bringing our personal beefs to the podcast?
No, never.
Don't download screeners, guys. Go see movies. Don't ruin my future by bankrupting the movie theaters.
Sorry.
That's fine.
Oh, that's spaghetti, you know?
Yeah.
Spaghetti and butter. How full is your theater?
When I walked in, I was surprised at how full it was. It's not like it was a packed theater, and it wasn't one of the bigger screens. But it was fuller than I anticipated, for sure. There was probably 50 people in there.
Who was there?
Humans, mostly. I don't know. I didn't really look around all that much. I was kind of the first person. Like, I was in the third row, and nobody was sitting in front of me. So okay. It's kind of weird to turn around and look around.
Yeah, lots of laughs.
Yeah. Most people seem to be laughing more than me.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, it was certainly well received by the crowd. And yourself?
There was me, my guest, and two other people.
Well, that's unfortunate. I suppose I live in a more metropolitan city.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah. Let's start at the beginning of the movie, I guess. Well, actually, let's start with some production stuff, just because we kind of touched on the silent era kind of coming to an end, and Chaplin kind of having his own way and, you know, being able to make this more of a silent movie, even as the era talkies kind of gets underway. Mm-hmm. So it took him like 3 years to make this movie.
Yeah, that's one of the things I found out in researching this film, is the man didn't move quickly, you know?
No, I mean, he was capable of it. There's times in his life when he had to make a movie a week. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a short film, wasn't as long as this, obviously. And he can do that. But no, he was very much known as a perfectionist. And, you know, writing, directing, editing, composing can take a lot of time. Mm-hmm. But even beyond that, you know, he took some breaks making this movie. If you get frustrated or not really know what to do, he would have the whole crew on standby while he took a few weeks off, which is insane to me.
Yeah. Well, I think Kubrick did shit like that too at points in his career.
And he's also a crazy person.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's generally like the greater somebody is at something they are, the crazier they are as a normal human, right?
Yeah, and so he fired Virginia Cheryl at one point, the woman who plays the blind character in this.
Oh, that was something that surprised me about this movie. I was surprised that somebody playing a blind person in 1931 was good. You know, like her performance as being blind, like I bought it, you know, like, and I think that it seemed like something that would have been so overplayed had I been supposed to guess. Like, she's just constantly touching walls to let you know that she's still blind. But that was something that I was like, oh yeah, she's blind, but she's not overselling it.
Yeah, and we We talked about that a bit with our Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf podcast that we did recently about how stilted some things can be, especially if people have come from the world of theater, stage, things like that. And no, the blind performance is very understated and to the point where you're not sure if she's blind for a bit. The tramp isn't sure. And even when that's made clear, no, she's not like tripping over things and like constantly bumping into stuff.
She doesn't have a single pratfall in this movie.
I know. And that's something, you know, something really kind of endearing about this movie. I think it's got a lot of sentimentality. There is a lot of sweet stuff in here. Obviously, the very ending is something people point to a lot for that. But yeah, her blindness is not the source of any humor, which, you know, you would think someone coming from slapstick, the blind character is a factory of jokes and you know, falling over and bumping into stuff. But all the humor really comes from Chaplin's actions in this one.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but he fired Virginia Cheryl. That's
right. Oh yeah, he fired her and then couldn't find anyone to replace her and had to hire her back at double her rate because they know they'd already shot too much with her to completely do everything again after kind of 2 years had already gone down the drain, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah, as I was saying, this one's kind of a bit of a crossover for the talkie in the silent era. When you kind of get the first bit of dialogue in this movie is when the mayor or some city officials seem to be presenting that new statue.
Yeah,
and you kind of get a bit of almost Charlie Brown parent talk.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought of. Yeah. Charlie Brown.
Did you think that was audio problems at first, or what did you make of that?
Oh, no, I assumed it was intentional. Because I knew the movie came out in 1931. I hadn't read much about it before I saw it, but the second I heard that voice, I was like, oh, okay, so he's saying something about talkies in this, you know, it's saying, like, these words don't matter, you know?
And that's how you read that as kind of a statement on talkies?
Definitely, because it's right up front. I think that's important about it. I do also think that it is sort of it's a part of the contrast with the tramp as well. I see it as having a double meaning, you know, especially since we get the reveal of the tramp on a brand new statue, which is like a symbol of opulence. And so I think it is a double meaning there. You know, this person is clearly wants for little and is clearly in charge of the situation that he's in, but his words don't matter, you know? And also just in general, words don't matter. It's about physical performance, which we then get immediately upon the tramp's reveal, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, if you want to run with the political social politics thing, you could say, you know, the politicians are full of hot air and what they say doesn't really have any content. But I think even that's a bit of a stretch. I love that reveal of him on the statue and him trying to get down.
Yeah, it's great.
It's absolutely fantastic. And I remembered that and still found myself laughing harder than I anticipated I would.
Yeah. Louder than the other one person.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but I do like that scene a lot. And again, like if you want to, you can you can read into some of those things as well. Like when and we have to keep in mind that during the 3 years that this movie is made, we have you know, the Great Depression really getting underway. And
yeah, the stock market crash happens at some point during the making of this film,
yeah,
correct?
During the making of this movie. So, again, really kind of reinforcing that idea of have and have nots and just the very different lives people lead because of income inequality. And so we have when as he's getting down from the statue and that the sword of the statue goes through that hole in his pants and he doesn't really have the ground to stand on when he wants to show respect to his country. You know what I mean? Like that's something about the tramp is that he is almost always extremely respectful or at least attempting to be extremely respectful. And, you know, when you see him try to stand up, you know, you see his best to try to be a good citizen and things like that. And then his legs start kicking out from under him and he's just standing there kind of spinning. And, you know, what what starts off as an attempt to look very stoic and patriotic ends up looking so goofy and disrespectful. And I mean, that's the Tramp's entire character, like throughout his whole career. And the fact that it gets summed up so quickly in a few seconds at the beginning of this movie, and as always, without him saying a single word, I think just kind of he speaks to the writing and to the performing and just the universality of it. Like, how can you don't need to know anything about where he is or what he does to find that bit of physical comedy popular. And, you know, that's why he was such a worldwide star.
Yep.
Just the one more thing about him trying to have good manners, him constantly tipping his hat during that scene.
Yeah.
I love that so much because it's the utmost important to him that people see him as a gentleman, and no one ever does. But he's just so, like, so steadfast and unwavering in this opinion that he is a classy guy, and he deserves the same amount of respect as everyone else, despite his clothes and his appearance and his homelessness and financial situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then he meets the blind woman. Does she ever get a name? I don't think so, right?
No, there's a lot of prepositions in character names in this film.
Even the cast list they show at the very beginning, it's eccentric millionaire and tramp.
A tramp, a blind girl. There are more of us out there. These are just the ones we're focused on.
Yeah, absolutely. How about the boxing match?
I enjoyed the boxing match quite a bit. I think the hardest laugh I had in this movie is when they the guy that's rubbing the rabbit's foot all over himself before he goes to the fight, when he gets carried back in unconscious, I laughed really hard. I thought that was a really funny moment. When Chaplin actually does get in the ring and he's doing the dance behind the referee, like with the referee between him and his opponent, I found that quite funny.
Yeah, and from a technical standpoint, I mean, that's no editing for a pretty long, physical, complicated shot. No.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely. It's something I like a lot. I enjoy blocking. You know, as much as actors hate it, I enjoy it when it's done well. You know, and I like when you can get a lot done in one frame. Be it, you know, by having four different camera setups in one shot, which is not something that Chaplin would do, or by just having a lot of action in one shot, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, and so I guess for that scene, it was choreographed for weeks and weeks and then shot over a few days, and Chaplin was really proud of it and invited a lot of his friends and told the cast and crew to invite their friends to come up for when they actually filmed it, because, you know, it's a few minutes of usually three people, but, you know, if you count the people in the corners and stuff like that who do have to do everything properly as well, probably eight or nine people with very, very specific dance moves. Like, it's, you know, it's not, they don't just call it choreography for nothing. Like, it's very, very complicated, incredible timing, use of props, and still trying to be kind of loose and funny enough with it that it seems natural and entertaining.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's one of I think Chaplin's, you know, most iconic scenes would be this one. Again, City Lights is my favorite, but I really, really do like that boxing scene. And when you think of how much of a perfectionist and how much work he was willing to put in, and you know, you really could do that shot with edits. It really would not be that hard to find a place to put it in there. I think it's incredible, and I think that's something that a lot of people really liked about him. Was that level of work he was willing to put into it. And even when he was one of the richest people on the planet and one of the most famous people on the planet, given his history, you know, which we haven't talked about much, but he grew up very, very poor, in workhouses as a child. And then when he could go on the road, he was, you know, traveling, you know, just very, very working class, very, very poor lifestyle growing up the whole time. And then was just very much a self-made man and, you know, worked really hard to get where he was. So I think with that history and with some of that, the political themes we talked about earlier about, you know, just being an everyman and fighting for the underclass and things like that, I think people were always able to relate to him. And you know, that's how you get people in poor countries and people all around the world and, you know, people in an economic depression to relate to you and love you and spend what very little money they have to go see your work.
Yeah, exactly. And even to sort of add a more modern example for the, you know, the people that are our age that probably haven't seen a lot of Chaplin. You know, Jackie Chan had a lot of the same sort of philosophies towards making action when he was in his heyday. A lot of things would happen in one wide shot, and these are still faster cut films, but there were things that he just sort of had to dedicate himself to trying 100 times before he got it perfect, and like kicking a pencil out of the air or something. And they might have been smaller stunts with less choreography just because they'd break it down and cut it up a bit more. But still, that it was that sort of like, you can see everything that's happening and you know that there's no faking happening, and that's impressive. And that's how Jackie Chan was kind of able to become a worldwide star in a totally different era, for slightly different reasons, but not as different as one might think when watching City Lights and Rumble in the Bronx back to back, you know?
No, absolutely. I think that's a great comparison. Yeah. It's people
and he was more of a Buster Keaton guy. Like Jackie Chan was a huge Buster Keaton fan. And from my limited knowledge of Keaton, he was bigger on stunt-like setups, which so that makes sense. Jackie Chan certainly isn't throwing shade at Charlie Chaplin in interviews or anything. You know, like, I'm certain he's a big fan of him too.
No, absolutely. But it's people who, you know, got to the top of their game and really could have started taking shortcuts and, yeah, you know, did not need to do these extremely dangerous stunts over and over, but exactly, just continued to. And yeah, it shows.
And even Jackie Chan, like, he's into his 50s before he starts taking shortcuts. You know, like Rush Hour 2, he's like 52 when that movie gets made. And he's still jumping through the tiniest, like, window where poker chips are handed through at a casino. And he slides through that thing. And he's like middle-aged man. It's amazing. Anyway.
No, I like it.
Yeah. So I like physical comedy a lot. I like it more when it's got face kicks involved. You know, I'm a Jackie Chan guy. What can I say?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. That's fair.
Yeah.
You take the face kicks over just eating streamers and thinking it's spaghetti.
That was one of the gags that I like could have cut a minute out of. You know, there were a couple things in this movie where I was just like, okay, I get it. We've played this past the point of its usefulness, and I don't think you're going alt comedy with it and making it last for another 8 minutes, so I don't think this gag's gonna become funny again to me. So I could have dealt with a little less streamer.
Okay,
yeah,
I'll keep that in mind. Uh-huh. Any other kind of small like physical things, because there's, you know, as you said, Arbuckle's kind of more about the big stunts, and you know,
Keaton, you mean?
Yeah, who did I say?
Arbuckle.
Yeah, sorry, I was reading about Fatty Arbuckle earlier.
don't worry, we got the name Fatty Arbuckle in the podcast.
Good. Yeah, and I mean, Chaplin certainly did a lot of those dangerous stunts, but he wasn't as big as, you know, like Harold Lloyd hanging off that clock, yep, or the house is falling on you, but yep, you land with you know, you go through the window kind of thing. I like a lot of kind of the smaller subtle stuff, which is still can be very acrobatic and involve a lot of physicality. But were there any kind of smaller little, even like 1 second gags at a time that you liked?
Oh man, I mean, I think that's just like the whole movie. It's just like him doing little impressive things constantly. Like that's the Chaplin thing. It's that there's just so many of them. I couldn't possibly come up with one because they're just constant.
Yeah, know? And I guess that's goes back to the workhorse kind of thing where it's just like you could see him thinking of a scene and wondering, you know, where can you plug one more joke in? What can I walk in a certain way that's going to keep things entertaining? Can I, after he takes the banana and puts it back in the bowl, can I grab it with my other hand and shove it down my pants and walk away? Mm-hmm. And, you know, like just any little thing to kind of keep the humor going. And it's, yeah, it's very nonstop. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, I just didn't know if you had any that you liked in particular.
No, it's just kind of constant. I think I have 87 minutes of them.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want to talk about the final scene or do you have some more in the interim to get to?
No, not really. I think it's a very simple movie, right?
Yeah, and a lot of them are. And
yeah, yeah, of course. And part of that is the time, and it's also part of the Chaplin aesthetic. Like you said, the fact that he was able to be such a worldwide star is because these were very easy universal themes to attach to. You know, like even the city that they're in, you have no idea what city they're in. They're just in a city, and there are.
Like, England, America, like, I don't know.
I was reading that there are elements of a variety of big cities that were put into the set design, but it was a specific choice to have it not look like a specific city.
Yeah.
It's just...
And on that same note, part of his reluctance to go, you know, full talkie with this was giving the tramp a voice. Mm-hmm. He thought it might make the character less universal the second he opened his mouth. What if he's speaking a language different than what you always pictured him speaking? What if it's too high? What if it's too low? Like, it's just, when you start getting specific, you lose some of your audience because it's as broad. And I know people always talk about broad art and broad comedy in a really pejorative way, but mm-hmm. in this case, it's, you know, these are simple stories, but it's, the execution isn't simple at all. That's what we were talking about, of him just being nonstop entertaining and him always providing something physical to keep you interested. Like, while the story is so simple, only he could have done it in that way. And that's why he got where he is.
Yeah, for sure. I suppose I do have one question for you. What does this movie say about alcohol? What is this movie's take on alcohol? Because it doesn't seem like anything bad happens to the tramp when alcohol is involved, and it only turns bad when the rich guy sobers up.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I don't think it says anything really about it in particular. I think it's just very present in this movie because it was very present in the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he wouldn't be in so much trouble if the alcohol didn't get him mixed up with the millionaire in the first place.
Yeah, but I think, do you think he would be happier with his life if he never gets mixed up with the millionaire and never has an opportunity to buy all the flowers from the flower girl and fix her eyes magically with $1,000? I think alcohol eventually makes him a happier person, although we obviously see plenty of examples of how it kind of destroys the rich person, but we never really are meant to see him as a not good person. He's just he's a person that it seems to be horrible when he's sober and has no control over himself when he's drunk, you know? And I don't know. Yeah. I just found this movie's take on alcohol very interesting. It does not, admittedly, I know it makes his life worse because he's attempts suicide multiple times in this film while drunk, but like what I'm saying is that we're never really supposed to care about him, but we're always supposed to care about the tramp, and alcohol does nothing but make the tramp's life better. All he has to do is stop a guy from killing himself a couple times, which doesn't seem to take a lot of persuasion.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say.
He does all the tramp all, does almost drown because of this, but
yeah, and when the tramp does get drunk, it makes him clumsy and do dumb stuff. But I don't know how much different that is.
Exactly,
the tramp's entire
exactly. Sister. It was just more eye work, you know. Pretty much everything else is the same.
That's true. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we talked about it on Virginia Woolf. People used to drink a lot. No, I don't know what it says. I think that I think we're meant to believe that alcohol isn't the reason that the tramp and the flower girl end up in a good position.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't think it's gin that gets them together, but it doesn't hurt. Yeah. So I was just curious. It just sort of felt like a weird way to portray alcohol throughout the movie.
Yeah, I think it's more of a catalyst for action than something that's having anything said about it in the movie.
Okay, the only reason I was thinking about it beyond, oh, that's an interesting way to show alcohol in a film, is just because I read about some historian that seemed to think that this movie was very autobiographical for Chaplin, and he had a drunk father. or Drunk for a Father. And I was like, well, I mean, if it's autobiographical, he didn't really care about his father's drinking, I don't think, all that much.
Yeah, no, I've heard this is kind of autobiographical. I mean, like a lot of Chaplin's work.
Like a lot of most directors' work, it's autobiographical in some way. Yeah,
and particularly late career Chaplin is when that gets very, very intense, like Monsieur Verdot and Limelight and things like that. No, but yeah, he did. He definitely did have an alcoholic father, and people point to the blind girl in this movie as his mother, as someone with physical. And I mean, his mother also had some mental disabilities, and this disabled woman who Charlie needs to help, and he, you know, he worked very hard as a child and did what he could to keep his mother's life as good as it could be near the end. But you know, she did die around this time, actually. Anyway, so some people have pointed to that, and I mean, he wasn't the one to invent the damsel in distress, that's for sure. But a lot of people read that into some probably nonsensical guilt that he has about his mother and the horrible part of her life that he witnessed while he was still alive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. He didn't have a super good life all the time.
No, that is true. He did not.
Oh, well, but we were going to talk about the ending.
Okay. Let's, I have conflicted feelings. I understand why the ending is well liked. I understand that in 1931, such sentimentality would be more okay. The thing I found really interesting was when I thought the movie was going to end with the blind girl not recognizing the tramp. When it just sort of like, now that she can see, she can make fun of him. I thought that was incredibly interesting. And then when they sort of touch hands and she realizes who he really is, I thought that was a little more sentimental than I tend to like. I did find that minute long segment where she's just sort of laughing at the tramp, just like anybody else would, despite the way she is treated previously in the film. I found that really interesting, you know?
Yeah, and well, first about the sentimentality of it. I think for the time, it's a lot more what you would like than what is normally going on.
Yeah, I'm sure I would have fallen over myself for this movie in 1931 if I was 28 and loved film in 1931. Yeah,
yeah, but I just mean the ending. It's not that sentimental, really. Like it's a little bit open-ended. Now, I would obviously say that it's very likely that they figure out who each other are or fall in love and things are great. Mm-hmm. But you don't get the big swelling score and then kissing and embracing and walking off into the sunset. There still is a question mark about whether she's going to be able to live with someone. Like, he's homeless, man. Like, he's... she's got her life. She seems to be having a pretty successful business. She can see.
He's a felon.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it all is, you know, cutesy and funny and played off well. But if the fact that she doesn't say, like, oh, it's you, I love you, let's get married, leaves the kind of the question mark of what is actually going to happen here. What is the next move? Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I mean, he is a homeless ex-con. It's not that simple at this point for them to get together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree that it's a little sweet, but I don't think it's out of control. And I think for the time period, it's probably very, very, very ambiguous compared to other endings of, you know, romance movies of the period.
Yeah, where the epilogue was a 500-word summation of the rest of their lives on screen.
And how many great grandchildren they have. Yeah. Like, you really don't get that. And no, and I do really like that moment, though. You're right. Like, if it ended kind of before that, because that moment where he, you know, he's kind of got his back to the window and she's looking at him and then he slowly makes eye contact. And, you know, obviously the viewer knows who everyone is. It's the first time he's seen her in a while. And it's the first time he knows she can see him. And it kind of gets you know, push it to the background. But the second half of this movie is supposed to focus on him making enough money to get her surgery.
Yeah.
Like, it's not always present. It, yeah. Like, you know it, you know, structurally that that's what's supposed to be going on. But it's just a lot of goofy hijinks with hoping to get money. Like, the boxing match was supposed to be for him to get the money to get the surgery, but you're not thinking about the surgery during the boxing match. You're thinking about how funny it all is.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, half of this movie is him trying to get enough money for her, I think, with the belief that, you know, if he gets her this surgery, then she'll love him so much that she has no choice but to be with him. Mm-hmm. And they both do seem like genuinely sweet people, so you want it to work out for both of them. Mm-hmm. But what kind of hits him, and I think hits the viewer at that moment when they make eye contact and she is kind of pitying him and says, oh, you can have this better flower for free and I'll also give you this spare change and you can buy yourself a hot meal or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. You get this point that you don't see a lot in romance movies where this disconnect, which is incredible, of one person pitying someone so gratefully and not like pitting them is a friendship kind of way, but it's like, you're a complete stranger who clearly has nothing going on for you. I pity you so much. Here's some money. That's a tough thing to deal with someone you're romantically interested in. So, you know, I think that works emotionally. And then I think the other thing is he kind of realizes the fault in his scheme, which was, well, not scheme, but his plan, which was he thought that his sight, or her getting sight, was going to bring them together. Mm-hmm. And I think all of a sudden it hits them that that might be the thing that keeps them apart now. Now that she can see him and see who he really is and how poor he is and how that he's not a rich gentleman with a Rolls Royce and a well-tailored suit, that it's hopeless. And yeah. Now that this woman he's been pining for all this time and doing all this work for and spent money on to get her the surgery, maybe that's going to end things. Whereas maybe if she was still blind, you could still kind of play the role, and even though it's not perfect, they'd still be together and she thinks of him as this great rich guy. It's one of those frustrating things where your plan worked, but maybe it's not, like, you're not going to get the result, you know, like the surgery was a success but the patient died. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really, really sweet part too, and I think it's again is not the ending you would expect from a movie that period where things are just always work out. You have a plan, you know, you hit some bumps, but then you overcome and then everything's great. It was his curing of her blindness that he thought was going to be the thing that inevitably brings them together. But it kind of becomes clear that that might be the thing that keeps them apart. And, you know, as we were touching on before about the blindness being not used as this gag, like, I was thinking of the episode of Arrested Development where the Julie Louis-Dreyfus playing the blind lawyer, and that scene of Tobias you know, sneaking around her house and, you know, like, falling over stuff and hiding and wearing her perfume and stuff like that. Uh-huh. Very funny scene. Mm-hmm. And you would think Chaplin, who is very acrobatic and very talented as a physical comedian, would lean on that hard, but that's not what the blindness is in this movie. It's to build things emotionally, and it serves a narrative function, but it's not to get slapstick goofy stuff. And, you know, as we saw in that episode of Arrested Development, which I think is super funny, mm-hmm. You definitely can do that, but that's really not, you know, what he used the blindness for in this. And I thought that was a really nice thing, and something about just kind of that realistic thing that he had with people, and that being a very important part of her life. You know, it's not downplayed like that. There is the one moment where she's cleaning out the flower pot and thinks he's gone and throws the water in his face, which is a good surprise and funny. And but again, it's not this broad moment of physical comedy where, you know, she slips in a banana peel or something awful. You know, it's at his expense. He's the one getting the water in the face. And it's also, you know, thematic. It's kind of like, this guy's been almost literally under your nose the whole time. Like, here's this guy that you just can't see. And I want to know what you thought about that last bit of dialogue where, she says, you, and he said, yeah, you can see now. And she says, I can. And again, we kind of fall short of that. Like, I can see you, and you're that guy who's perfect and all this. Like, she just says, I can see now. And then I think that's a nice ambiguous kind of ending to it. And I think it definitely gives a positive note at the end, but I think it's nicely open-ended.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I suppose. I think it's just sort of, maybe I just sort of assume she'll do at least something nice, whether or not they end up in any sort of romantic relationship. He gave her $1,000, you know, like there's some, and just from everything we've been told about this character at this point, the blind girl, she would feel some sort of guilt about just taking $1,000 and being able to see. Like, I feel like that's an even bigger turn than, you know, I had talked about the fact that now she can see him, she can make fun of him. Like now that she's normal, I think that would be saying too much about how every normal person is a piece of shit that will take your money. I think that would be a little too much. And I didn't assume that jump, you know, or right. Anything like that jump. I just sort of think that what everything this movie tells us about, or what wants us to think about humanity in general, especially since we're supposed to care the most about the tramp number one and blind girl number two, is that humanity isn't terrible, you know, like you sort of have to have some faith in humanity. And I think this movie wants us to think that things work out at least okay for the tramp, if not ideally, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And certainly easier than it would have been for him to keep up his whole I'm a rich guy thing, which would have been extremely difficult and exhausting for him to do.
And he's going to keep stealing that Rolls Royce over and over.
Yeah, exactly.
From a house he was, you know, charged with committing burglary. Yeah. So they might have an eye out. We should talk about the importance of that scene, though. It was kind of like, it's Chaplin, even while making this movie, saw it as the center of this movie and kind of worked backwards from there. Mm-hmm. The blind plot came from another movie he had been working on in 1928, and then thought of this idea of this blind girl and him getting the money for the surgery and, you know, everything that ended up being City Lights. But he wrote a very, very detailed description of how this scene should work out. And
which was not the norm for him, from what I know.
Well, yeah. Well, they did, I think, 342 takes of that ending scene.
Yeah. It's a lot.
Which is a whole lot, which is incredible. But, I mean, I guess it worked because a lot of people think of it as like the best closing in cinema history. Mm. James Agee, who is a well-respected film critic, mm-hmm. says it's the best acting ever committed to celluloid, which is pretty high praise.
I would say. And he said that in 1949, I think. You know,
right.
So if he was still alive and had watched all of the films since then, he might not still agree with that. But yes, at one point it was considered by one of the most highly respected American critics that some of the best acting ever, you know.
Yeah.
And still was almost 20 years later.
Yeah. And I mean, we could go on and on about Chaplin's legacy, but this movie in particular definitely had an impact, we'll say. I mean, yeah. It's in the National Film Registry, sometimes talked about it, one of the best movies ever made. Orson Welles says it was his favorite movie. Chaplin says it was probably his favorite movies he made. It's Woody Allen's favorite Chaplin movie.
Kubrick loved it too. One of his 10 favorites.
Yeah, I think he said 5 out of 10, which is not bad.
Yeah, that was in the 60s, I think.
Okay. Okay.
I just like to qualify these things, you know.
No, that's fair. That's fair.
39 years still left in his life, you know.
Yeah. Do you want to talk a bit about kind of the tramp character in general? Because I think we could talk about Chaplin as a person for a while. I mean, he's a very fascinating character. One of the, you know, we touched on it a bit, but one of the first auteurs, maybe the first auteur, one of the first international Hollywood stars, one of the first like global movie stars,
yeah.
And just one of the biggest public figures of his time. Well, still insanely influential.
Yeah, I think those two things, his worldwide success and notoriety, and the fact that he was able to sort of become the first auteur, they're tied directly together, because as we discussed, the only reason he was able to take so long making his movies and be such a perfectionist was because every time he put out a movie, he made bank, you know?
Yeah. And almost.
Well, yeah, sorry. But the at least at this period of time, the vast majority of yeah. the films he put out. And those two things go hand in hand. And yeah, it's really important that he was a celebrity to be able to become, to sort of work on, I suppose, his directorial voice, you know? But yeah, I think that's the thing I find the most interesting about Chaplin is the even back then, he still had to make money. You know, if Modern Times, which does Modern Times come before this? It does, right?
I think that's 34.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm wrong. Whatever the movie that came before City Lights was, if that doesn't make money, he probably doesn't get to have as much control over City Lights, right? Yeah. And that's just sort of... you know, it's interesting. Like, if he ever had an apocalypse now that bankrupted him, there might not in the 20s there might not be a City Lights. And he was right more often than he was wrong. And that's something that history still proves to us is the most important part about being able to become an auteur is to be able to be successful enough to be able to keep making films. You know?
Yeah, and the determination to keep doing it.
Exactly.
Like everyone has little failures. All like anyone who's been successful has failed many times on their way to success. It's about getting through that and mm-hmm. hopefully not having one of those failures be, you know, Ishtar or something huge in public.
Yeah. Critical opinion's kind of swaying back in Ishtar's favor, by the way.
Yes. More Ishtar jokes from you then?
Look, I'll mention Ishtar anytime I can. But yeah, there was a Blu-ray release like a year or two ago. Critics are sort of like reevaluating it. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But yeah, like I think you see this with the way Paul Thomas Anderson has been promoting Inherent Vice. He has been promoting it because he's had a lot. Like the Master didn't make money. This movie isn't making money. And he realizes that he needs to make money. So to be able to have the control that he's used to, that he's developed over the course of his career. And with the exception of There Will Be Blood, I don't think any of his movies have made that much money. And even There Will Be Blood didn't make that much money. And he knows the importance of maintaining control with like making money being important to maintaining control, and Chaplin made tons of money, so he was able to have tons of control, right?
Right, and then those things, I mean, that's a cycle though, right? Like I think Ricky Gervais would be a good contemporary example of someone who fought to keep control over everything he does, but then people think once he's involved with something, they know it's going to be good. Like he's not just going to attach his name on something that's bad. And I mean, you can... criticize the quality of certain things in his career.
Yeah. I was gonna say Ricky Gervais has made some bad shit. Yeah.
No, I know that, but yeah. it's from maintaining a level of control and, you know, putting your own money and name up front that people are more willing to gamble. And I mean, there was times when Chaplin, I mean, before he had reached this incredible amount of success, but when he was popular and doing well, you know, he would put his own money up. He wasn't a producer on something, he said, "I'll give you $1,500 if this movie's unsuccessful, as long as I get to direct, as long as we get to do it my way."
Yeah.
And I think that's part of his, like, there's part of that working class honesty where he would put his name and put his work ethic up front. And, you know, being a perfectionist and being, you know, a control freak or however you want to put it, he would put lots of time and lots of work into things, and that showed up in the product. And I think that also it became part of who he was. And I think that's why for him to be as successful as he was and still be so inextricably linked with this tramp character, I mean, he did it for decades, but it's not all he ever did. I think served him very well, because it was, this tramp was someone who just, I think, related to so many people at that time. And especially if we're going to talk about City Lights and we're going to talk about the stock market crash and we're going to talk about income inequality after that. He was just someone with the tramp was just this proper gentleman with this underlying belief that if you treat yourself and others with respect and you work hard, things are going to work out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you think of City Lights, just all the things that he goes through and all the work he does, and sometimes still becoming very, very unsuccessful at times. Like, even when he gets to go to that restaurant with the millionaire.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's waiting to be seated, and then they pull out his seat, and then they take his hat and his cane, and then he turns around and he sees another customer holding a hat and a cane. He thinks it's his, and he takes it back, and like he feels like he deserves respect. You know, he's not being an asshole about it, but he thinks that like he deserves some self-respect. He deserves to be respected. He just needs to kind of work hard and do his thing. And, you know, then he sits down and he lights a cigarette, but he never gets to puff on it because it's always the other guy's cigarette, or he puts the wrong one in his mouth, and mm-hmm. he tries it again. And you kind of see that look in his face, like he's about to release, and it's been a long day of, you know, work or stress or whatever, and he's about to finally inhale it, but it's not lit again. And that it's so speaks to the times of like there's this optimism and there's this hope in social mobility in the US, and whether or not that really existed or not, I think it was a very powerful idea. And he was someone who was always nice to people, nice to strangers, you know, helps the blind girl, helps that rich person he doesn't know, who doesn't know is rich, risks his life to stop him from killing himself. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think there's just a belief at that time that if you worked really hard and you're a nice person, things were going to work out. But the tramp is always kind of this victim of circumstance, and there's always more powerful at work that keeps him in place. And this movie doesn't end with him, you know, getting all the millionaire's money, or, you know,
it ends with Chaplin getting that.
Does it?
No,
Charlie. Yeah, no, absolutely. It does. But I mean, we don't see
We
don't see the tramp get all this money or get all this fame or, you know, score this cushy job or anything. What it is the money he earns, he gives away, and then that has showcased that he was a genuinely good person. And you kind of find happiness with where you are in your life. And it is tragic because there isn't that upward mobility. There isn't that big jump forward. There isn't this, if you're a really great guy, the economy's going to work out your way. But there is kind of a karma in the end, where if you're a genuinely good guy, you're not going to get everything, but you're going to get enough. And, you know, when you look at Charlie Chaplin's whole career and his biography, maybe that that karma didn't exist in his life. Maybe it did. But I think that's really what made him as famous as he was, and what makes him the enduring figure that he remains to be.
Yeah, I agree with that. You're saying that the tramp really stands for hard work and never giving up and all that. And I agree with that. Chaplin's version of never giving up involved upsetting a tremendous amount of people, you know, like crew members and, you know, cast members that hated him. Like the blind girl was not a fan of him.
Did you hear what she said about their romantic connection?
No.
Says, Charlie was never into me. I was 20 years old. He always wanted younger.
That was my next point. He seemed to be a big fan of marrying teenagers.
Knocking up 16-year-olds.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, sorry. I should say he's a fan of impregnating teenagers and then marrying them because he kind of had to avoid statutory rape charges. Yeah, I think there is certainly a disconnect between the tramp character and Chaplin's actual life. I'm not saying that it devalues the whole his whole career by any means, because I think art should stand apart from their artist to an extent. But I do think there is sort of an interesting contrast there that, yes, the tramp really stands for working hard and never giving up. And that was a big part of Chaplin's successes. But in Chaplin's like real world, that involves pissing off some people, you know, and not necessarily doing things properly all the time, you know? And that is something that we see with greatness all through the years. Like Michael Jordan would punch teammates in the face, you know, in practice if they said a bad pick.
And you're taking Hitler's side on the Hitler Chaplin debate.
Shut up. I think that there's just an interesting contrast to be thought of, you know, and that's about it.
Yeah. Oh, everyone makes himself look better on screen. That's for sure.
Yeah. Do you have anything more?
I have so much more, but
okay.
No, not enough to justify.
Well, that's why I'm asking you instead of vice versa, which is normally the way, because I know this is more you than me sort of topic. Yeah,
I think his career is incredible and unprecedented, and no one like him will ever exist again, just because of the way that media is so diverse, and there's just not a big. It's just not a big one big spotlight to put on one individual anymore. But like his legacy is still being felt. Like I don't know if anyone else would have done exactly what he did. Obviously, a lot of the things he did would have been done by someone eventually. But it's incredible to have this one figure so early on in cinema that ended up doing so much of what cinema would become.
Yeah,
like it's incredible that he was this auteur. He's the in insane rags to riches story. You know, got brought in by Hollywood and then idolized by Hollywood and then victimized and sent away by Hollywood. And again, I'm certainly not going to do anything about defending the you know, kind of personal things we've been discussing and, you know, knocking up 16-year-olds.
Yeah, exactly.
But he was on the right side of history for a lot of the things that kind of got him vilified.
Mm-hmm.
People were pretty upset that he got political, calling out Hitler in 1939.
Yeah.
I think we know where he if he was on the right side of that one. You know, McCarthyism got him kicked out. Even very staunch conservatives look back on McCarthyism as quite a farce and a witch hunt. So, yeah, I mean, the rags to riches, the incredible amount of control, the incredible influence he has on a single medium. I really don't think there's another individual who has had as much impact on cinema as Charlie Chaplin. And I'm not even joking at all when I say that. And then, yeah, just being brought into Hollywood, being kind of idolized, being victimized, and then kind of being forgiven and brought back, and now history remembers him this positively. I think that is so many stories that have come out of Hollywood and come out of cinema as a whole, and it's just amazing to find someone who encompasses all these things while being very hardworking and incredibly talented, like very, very passionate, very physically talented, very talented on screen, very charismatic, very talented behind the scenes, writing, directing, composing, editing. He's just all of Hollywood, and it's just so crazy to have it all kind of rolled up into one ball. And not everything he did was great personally or cinema wise, but as a figure for what cinema is, there is no one greater, and I'm pretty sure there won't be.
All right, so I think we can just end this podcast with a 12-minute standing ovation.
Yeah, good.
But yeah, thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check out our website, themacguffin.com, for all of our future episodes. All right, thanks for listening.
Next week we're doing Chappie.
Chappie, our biopic about Charlie Chaplin. We're correcting all the mistakes in the Robert Downey Jr. version.
He was a robot, number one.
He was Hugh Jackman, number two.
And Dev Patel was there the whole time.
All right, so check back for that next week.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.